You're listening to the Unsung Podcast, where we talk about albums that we think are unsung classics, and then you guys tell us if you're right or wrong. This is the Unsung Podcast. Episode 52 of the Unsung Podcast. That's right, folks, we've made it an entire year, 52 straight goddamn weeks without missing a beat. Thank you very much to everybody who's listened thus far. On last week's episode, we were discussing Emotion Side B by Carly Rae Jepsen. And the public have decided that Carly Rae Jepsen's Emotion Side B does not make it into a discography, so thank you very much to everybody who listened and voted. On this episode, we're discussing Meantime by Helmet. Enjoy. You're listening to the Unsung Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Fraser, and I'm joined by two men who I've just found out, along with me, are now so old that we're actually like 6 months behind the latest memes.
What have we just found out?
That we're behind the latest memes.
6 months at least.
Oh, are we talking about Little Mix Jamaican accent
yeah.
one? Yeah, I only came across this last week and Chris only came across today.
6 months is a compliment to me. I mean, I would probably have been turning 50 and be like, Mark,
have you seen Charlie bit my finger?
If you're not from Scotland, Scottish people by the time they get to 50 all sound like that. Like life expectancy is around about the high 40s. Apparently Little Mix do a quality impersonation of a Jamaican accent.
It's fantastic. Sitting to my right is Glasgow's greatest Jamaican impressionist, Chris Cusack.
Hey, the man. What is it she does?
And she goes, "Bardic."
That's brilliant. Go internet.
How old are we?
It's so good.
Sitting to my left is the young Tory David Weaver, who refused to drink despite the fact this is the last unsung recording of 2018. We are going to do this episode and then we're going to do the unsung parts A and B Christmas special. So drinks are flowing.
I do not see how that makes me a conservative.
Because you're cautious and reserved and
pro-Brexit.
In what way are the Conservatives this year being reserved and cautious? They're just like,
because you're reckless and internally conflicted and you hate foreigners.
He's just went to Tenerife, so he can't, well, I suppose.
He didn't argue with that.
Oh no, do you know what? Like, it's weird. I've just been in Tenerife for my Christmas night out. And it's very weird that you go to Europe and to the resorts in Spain to find the most Brexit-y people on earth.
That is true.
My God, some of the humans there are unbelievable. Just
the lack of self-awareness is stunning. The Brits that are in Spain leeching off the superior Spanish health service. Like the fact that in Spain it's famous for the quality of its surgery in particular. So as you get older, people move to Spain to try and mooch their operations, things like hip replacements and stuff like that, because the surgeons over there are notoriously good, and yet they still have the audacity to vote for Brexit.
I don't want that paella stuff.
Our country, bring our country under our laws, country, control.
If you've never specifically an English person, okay, I'm gonna be a little racist here. If you've never heard an English expat speaking Spanish, it's just English loudly.
Cerveza, cerveza, a beer, yeah, one of those beer things, yeah.
Is that Jamaican? Is that a Little mixed Jamaican accent? So yeah, it's been quite a week in British politics, sort of somewhere between Some Mothers Do Avum and Thundercats.
Big apologies to all our English listeners. Yeah. Also, I should have something to add. On the week where we were 94th in South Africa's Arts and Entertainment Podcast on Spotify.
That's amazing.
That's pretty good.
Pretty good.
Thank you, South Africa.
Thanks,
take back everything I said about you during the 80s.
I'm not even going to try and do a South African accent. South Africa.
That was not too bad.
Diplomatic immunity.
When I went to New Zealand a couple of years ago,
is that in South Africa?
I completely failed to be able to do a New Zealand accent, and it just always came out as South African.
I can do one.
Yeah. Whenever I try to do an accent, I fuck it.
Fucking prawns,
bitch.
This is the most Scottish moment of my life. I'm currently using an oat cake as a coaster for a glass of whiskey.
That's Irish whiskey though, so.
Oh shit, it is.
So I'm afraid it's just fully Celtic.
That's the Celtic.
Some kind of Brexit.
The Celtic
and ginger beer, there. That's Jamaican. Fusion there.
Oh, so, it's true. And limes.
Mm-hmm.
Where are they from?
Sainsbury's.
In the same week that David was in Tenerife, sunning it up, driving up and down mountains, I believe. I was, if you remember last week, from my weird little run-in at the arts centre with that dapper.
I was thinking about this, man. He's been asked that question before. That's happened to him before. He's like offered a seat. Like, that's why he was so quick to answer. Because yeah. He's definitely been asked that before.
Yeah, it's just a prop walking stick. Well, I just went around Glasgow for the last week kicking walking sticks away from people trying to work out who's real and who's not. Turns out most of them are real. And they wanted a seat.
Damn.
By the way, I deliberately, much like you, Mark, last week during the Carly Rae Jepsen, after you calmed down.
I'm still not calm.
The audience have no idea how much I cut out of that edit, by the way.
I was talking an hour and a half long.
I've got a personal version of that that is just blue. I deliberately, much like Mark last week, who chose not to listen to
anything by Carly Rae Jepsen apart from the albums in question.
To stay innocent and untainted by the hipster credentials. I didn't look at the results of our poll, so how is Carly doing?
It's about 60-40 against at the moment.
Praise be.
By the time this comes out, it'll still be 60-40.
It's had a few votes, though.
It has. There's been a lot of it, a lot of discussion about people who really fucking like it, like Dave, which I'm impressed by. I think it was a good choice, Dave.
Thanks.
I'm actually sad it's not going to go in, even though I didn't like it, but I think it would have been good for us if it was in there.
Yeah, I know.
What the fuck are you talking about? Things.
It would have been good. It would have been like, oh, those guys have got a bit of, you know, hipster credentials. Maybe we'll get in his pitch.
Should have put LaRue in.
No, absolutely not.
She's like 7 years out of date, mate.
Well, hi-yo, we have a certain feature in the Christmas special.
Maybe we could come to some sort of no deal or deal thing. You get Carly, I get Carly, and you get LaRue.
Dave, we all have a Christmas present where we can all put in one record in the Christmas special. Let's wait until next week to find out how that goes.
Okay, let's wait. I can't wait.
Dramatically dragging down the overall quality of the disco campaign in the process. Okay, so this week, to honour our first anniversary, we've not missed a week, by the way, folks. We would like your high fives for that, because
it's absolute madness.
We've tried so hard to miss a week.
Lots and lots and lots of podcasts just occasionally miss week and even take summer holidays and all that.
Yeah, we don't have enough of a back catalogue right now to just do, like, we pulled our favourite episode out the vault. Mm-hmm. We'll be doing that as soon as it's respectable. But we haven't missed a week. So this is to celebrate our year. As you may or may not know, the name Unsung is the title of a song by the band Helmet. And we have opted to cover Helmet, fittingly, for that first birthday.
Chris, you've had a bit of a stoner for this for the last month or two, haven't you?
52 weeks I've been resistant to this album.
Yeah.
Helmet were a very, very influential band, but they're also a very complicated unit in terms of where they started, where they finished, and what happened along the way. And I think it bears some sort of dissection in that sense. I was really conflicted about what to put forward for this, okay? And accordingly, we left Carly Rae Jepsen on a bit of a cliffhanger when I said, I don't know what album I'm going to do. And actually, I genuinely didn't. Okay, so they have one album that I think really stands out as a solid start to finish calling card of that band. Across some of their other material, they have arguably a better album, but mm-hmm. it's spread out and they've never quite attained the consistency or any number of combinations of factors to match that. We had people online taking a wee guess at what that might be. The main guess at what I was going to pick was actually surprisingly Betty, which is their third album.
It's the most lauded album by fans as well. It had a deluxe reissue, they toured, anniversaries of it, that kind of thing.
Which is not surprising in some ways. It was the highest charting album by Helmet. I think it went in at number 45. But it didn't sell anywhere near as much as Meantime, which is their biggest selling album at over 2 million units. And when you hear it, that's odd that an album that sounds like that sold over 2 million units. I am personally a massive fan of their fourth album, Aftertaste, which I think is incredibly underrated. It's far more tuneful, less obstinate. And on the flip side of that, I am a fucking massive fan of their first album, Strap It On. I think Strap It On is astonishing and as raw and as primitive as it was, it still sounds incredibly fresh. I have chosen Meantime. Okay. Now, some folk will... for Meantime. Meantime is Helmet's best album, full stop. And I'm willing to back that up. But I gave these guys a collection of other songs from drawn across, specifically the earlier part of their career. So there's also the phenomenon of Zombie Helmet. Zombie Helmet is what happened in 2004 when Helmet came back with Size Matters and onwards into a series of albums with diminishing returns, which really just an embodiment of Paige Hamilton and the Helmets. Paige Hamilton being the guy who started Helmet effectively, and is the only remaining member to this day after a slew, like a revolving door of different people in various jobs. But Helmet, up until the time of Aftertaste, is a formidable band in the extreme. They redefined a lot of alternative rock. They brought elements of hardcore into something approximating the mainstream. They brought elements of real eclecticism in terms of the timings. Paige Hamilton was a trained jazz musician. He's worked as a jazz guitarist for many really respected collectives. He's done soundtrack work. He used that to inform an early career that was incredibly fecund. And I think they're a band that really deserve probably more plaudits than they even got in terms of their influence. Now, unfortunately, part of that influence includes the fact that Helmet are maybe as much as anyone responsible for new metal.
They are probably the first new metal band.
Look, really, don't slag off an entire genre. We've, you know, we've already discussed that there are some great things to come out of new metal.
We must be them, along with, I guess, Rage and Faith No More and
Red Hot Chilis to some extent as well.
The first new metal bands.
Early Korn, yeah.
Well, Korn were new metal.
Korn were the first new metal band that were new metal, but then those bands before sort of created the sound.
Rocky kind of sound.
Yeah, from
Primus
other...
a bit as well. Primus have a little bit to bear with the kind of the funky kind of side of it. But anyway, Helmet and Faith No More are probably the two main offenders. Well, no, Helmet, Faith No More, and Radiance Machine are probably the three main offenders. And Paige Hamilton was really unhappy with that legacy. I mean, he has said that he doesn't feel that new metal sounds like Helmet. Obviously, he doesn't feel that, but it does a lot of things.
He seems like a bit of a grumpy cunt. Is that a fact?
I've met him, he is a
bit.
Was
he a grumpy cunt?
A wee bit. But let's not forget, this is one of the weird things about Paige Hamilton. He's 58. He was born in 1960, and he's still playing in a band that are like a full-on alternative rock and noise rock band.
Yeah.
Who do you know from your life that's nearly 60 years old?
He was 32 when he was doing this.
Well, he's still doing this.
Yeah, but no, when this album came out,
he was
32.
I mean, he is literally still doing this. He's 58 years old and he's still going up there and playing things like Bad Mood.
Yeah.
And that's fucking crazy.
Yeah, but is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a bad thing.
Yeah, I would say that as well.
Bring it into your own life. Who's 58 in your life and what are they doing right now?
Yeah, no. I love being into heavy music right now, but when I'm 58, I want to be a jazz man. I want to...
Well, he started as a jazz man.
I want my
work
blood,
backwards.
I want my blood type to be port. And I want to listen to fucking Miles Davis. That's pretty much it.
Like, how weird is that? That Paige Hamilton, as a young man, started as a jazz musician and has now, at the age of 58, become like a kind of stodgy metallic rocker. Like that is a weird part of it.
I think it's quite interesting because obviously he started off with the first couple of records, obviously this one, like having a lot of the jazz feel to the playing. So he's kind of taking that and obviously mired it with what he thought or what was at the time heavy music and hardcore. But somewhere along the way, he's not changed.
and everything else has.
Yeah, and it's kind of become really weird in that sense.
That's a really interesting phenomenon with Helmut, because it seems to me like Paige Hamilton and Helmut have become almost synonymous, or certainly to him. My argument would be that they're not to myself and probably most of the real hardcore fans. Helmut is John Stanier, Henry Bogdan, and Paige Hamilton.
Yeah, when I was listening to this record, one of the things that popped out to me is like, I don't really understand why those two guitars, other than the fact it's just for heaviness. A lot of the time they're doing, most of the time they're doing the same thing.
Well, he said when they came to do Aftertaste, they recorded Aftertaste as a trio, and he literally was quoted as saying, I don't need two guitarists to record this band. He's like, I'll do everything. And then they brought Chris Traynor from Orange 9mm in and the second guitar. But Helmut are an example of a guy who started to identify himself with this thing to a point where he wasn't necessarily able to extricate himself from that. And despite doing loads of other things, touring with David Bowie, he toured as a guitarist for David Bowie in 1999. But Paige Hamilton seems unwilling to accept that Helmut is dead. I mean, they scraped a decent, passable album, let's say, together in the form of Size Matters, and a lot of that was the result of a bunch of demos for a project called Gandhi that never really materialised. The band clearly has, I think in most people's eyes, run its course. People that still buy their records are picking through increasingly superfluous stuff to find nourishment, and you kind of wish that Zombie Helmut would just get a fucking knife through its brain. And even when they tour, like I went to see their 20th anniversary tour of Meantime, and it was okay, a little bit tragic. There was something a little bit distasteful about it. I mean, quite apart from the fact it was a massive power failure in the venue and the whole show kind of fell apart. It just, something feels disrespectful to their legacy. But how do you tell an artist, stop pissing on all the great stuff you did early on? Like, give it up. It's cool. Do something else. You maybe do still have something to bring to the table, but can we not bastardise this previous project? Henry Bogdan and John Stanier, I don't know if they're still not in talking terms with Paige Hamilton, but after the tour for Aftertaste, they split in 1998, and Hamilton said, you know, after like 1,600 concerts together, however many hours, 22 dates they did in 21 days. I don't know if he's being facetious or if they actually did like an in-store. He was like, they could barely look at each other. It's like they hated each other's company, and when he tried to get the original lineup together for the anniversary shows, etc., I think in some cases he didn't even reply to him. I mean, he still speaks in glowing terms about his ex-bandmates. He still speaks very highly of John Stanier. But yeah, to give a little bit of context, just very quickly, like Paige Hamilton was from Portland in Oregon. He relocated to New York. They kind of became a little bit involved in both the New York art scene and a little bit the New York hardcore scene. Helmut seemed to subvert a lot of those tropes.
They wore shirts.
They wore shirts, indeed.
I read about that a lot, about Helmut.
Did you?
Yeah, they seemed to not dress like normal metal bands or normal hardcore bands. They wore shirts. And that was really progressive and cool in the 90s to wear shirts.
Edge. Paige Hamilton had originally been in a band called Band of Susans. Band of Susans was odd. They were like a bit like Sonic Youth meets My Bloody Valentine. They had three guitarists at all stages throughout the career of that band, and they had this approach where each guitar would contribute to a wall of noise in a different way. So one would literally maybe just feedback for almost all of a song. The other would play like root notes. The other would play some kind of weird middly anti-solo. They constructed these big walls, but the tunes were actually quite melodic. And I think that informed, you were saying, why did Helmut have two guitarists? I think that's a big part of it. Certainly in the early Helmut stuff, you can hear the squall, the layers of things. And I put some of the tracks on that compilation. And they did have this slightly shoegazy approach, and sort of also quite a post-punky no-wave approach.
There was a lot more dynamic going on. I think there was a lot more highs and lows. I think one thing you can say about the album we're doing right now is it's quite narrow in its sound.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the stuff before,
it's focused though. Yeah. I think like narrow, I don't want that in the pejorative sense, because I think the reason this album works so well is that it's very focused.
A lot of metal bands, I mean, that's a very metal thing to do that as well. having two guitars playing the same thing sometimes as well, just for chunk, you know.
True,
there's a lot of that on this record.
I think on this one, but my point with some of Helmet's earlier stuff is that, especially the stuff that came off the back of Band of Susans, he had, especially at the ends of tracks, and you'll notice that I get your point with the chunkier riffs early on in the songs, but for a lot of the tracks, they actually descend into chaos. They did that with things like Sinatra on Strap It On, and they do it with a lot of the stuff like FBLA 2 towards the end of Meantime, where one guitar goes off in one direction, usually Hamilton, and it's usually an anti-solo. It sounds like it's been played wrong. It sounds like just some dafty like messing about, while the other guitar plays these big open chords. So you end up with like a kind of wall of noise with this kind of really unsettling thing weaving through it. It's a technique they use maybe like 3 or 4 times on this album alone, and that reflects that Band of Susans genesis. Now that's something they stopped doing as much in the later parts of their career. It became less of a feature of their songs. They were more direct, a bit more, dare I say it, even grungy, verse chorusy. But that use of the two guitars, where, like I said, where they get to almost the middle point of a tune and then the two guitars go in a fork in the road and they branch off and the song ends differently, it's a big part, even if people haven't really thought about why they like Helmet songs, why they have a sense of abandon, why they're called noise rock and not just alternative metal. It's the ends of the songs, it's the descent, it's the freedom that the band allows to happen in the ends of those songs. Band of Susans is really worth listening to. Hamilton wasn't in them for very long. He did that album, he did a John Peel EP. He'd actually only get into that band as well after he had been playing with the composer Glenn Branca, who died earlier this year. Hamilton has since fallen very far from the tree. I mean, he played on like Linkin Park's 6th album.
I saw that, yeah.
It's like a hell of a Nexus moment if you're looking for it. He's also in kind of mid-period. He's in stuff like Troublegum, the Therapy album.
Therapy was a band that really this reminded me of.
Yeah, and I think Therapy are a band we'll probably end up coming back to, because they're another band that their influence is really understated. Why?
I'm unfamiliar with Therapy, and I don't know much about them at all.
They actually were a band that kind of chart bothers for a while. They had a song called Diane that was pretty up there. I don't know where it charted, but I can see us actually probably coming around to doing something on that, because that was a period where noise rock and new approaches to alternative rock were coming to the fore, and Helmet were a big part of that. That's why he's on that album, because they really influenced a lot of these bands to push in new directions. Hey people, this is probably the last time of 2018 where your listening pleasure will be interrupted as we pursue Cash Dollar. And I'm going to take a different tack this time. It kind of occurs to me that the problem here isn't that people don't want to pay for the podcast. Almost anybody we speak to is more than happy to pay for this, be it at the kind of nominal suggested price of £1 an episode, or sometimes substantially more if you're Fritz. But what it seems to be is most of it, you know, oh, my phone's over there, I just shut my laptop, my payment page, I can't be bothered, don't then I'll do it later. It really seems to be more of a convenience thing. So if, for example, as part of your New Year's resolution, you can bring yourself to actually just open up your laptop or your phone and go to unsungpod.net/donate and make a donation to the podcast, because everybody seems pretty cool and willing and appreciative of the efforts we're making, that would be excellent. We would really appreciate that. You can also at the same time perhaps advise us as to ways that we can sort of mitigate people's, you know, busy lifestyles, but also like we're all a bit lazy and stuff from time to time. I relate more than most. Maybe you can tell us ways that we can make it easier for folk to just donate without it being a pain in the ass. Yeah, really, I think it's just about that little tiny bit of effort. So if you can just press pause, go to the unsungpod.net/donate, stick something on there, it'll really help us in the new year. We're going to get some new mics to do some interviews for next year, because that's one of our resolutions. We're going to generally try and move things along, improve the production quality and stuff. So if you can help us do that, that'd be fantastic. And we really had a lovely time in the last 12 months doing this. Not going to lie, I'm looking forward to a couple of weeks off, but it'll be a pleasure coming back as well. So we'll take you back to the podcast. But yeah, please just hit pause, go and stick something on it as a Christmas present to us. We're very grateful. Or just give us some advice on how you think we can make that process easier for the modern human. Bye. So,
why meantime?
Exactly. Why meantime? Exactly. As I said, there were arguments for me for all of the first four albums.
I thought you were going to go with Betty. I did.
So did, I think, a few of the listeners. Helmet and Amphetamine Reptile, the label that they started on, were very, very closely associated in people's minds. Amphetamine Reptile have dealt with some amazing bands, and they're a label that we probably haven't talked about enough because they are so intrinsic to the early 90s sound, so intrinsic to the way that alternative rock went. But Amphetamine Reptile had bands like Surgery, the Janitor Joe, Cows, Guzzard. They also had Today's the Day.
Today's the Day, Unsane.
Unsane, Melvins, Brainiac, who
they released some Jesus Lizard as well, didn't they?
Yeah, they did Jesus Lizard. AmRep is a brilliant record label, and there's some compilations out there that are really, really excellent ways to get into AmRep and their back catalogue, something we'll probably touch on a lot more. But Strap It On was Helmet's like full-length debut. It was released in 91, although some places say 90. One of the genius moment aspects of Strap It On is that it's 30 minutes long, more or less. It's much more noise rock, really staccato in points. It's much closer to Meantime in feel. They make a lot of use of fucking with your preconceptions about the length of a bar and where a riff is about to go. I think it was referred to in the press by one writer as metal minus the clownish cliches, which I think is a really good way to discuss it. Really caustic. And for me was a real contender for this. I absolutely love that album, and it's actually an album that, because it's so unfussy in its production, has aged incredibly well, because it sounds dated but yet also sounds brutal. It is visceral in the way that they wrote and performed the tunes. A track on it, Bad Mood, is the height of simplicity. Starts with just two repetitions of a riff and then all the rest of the band come in. There's a track called Blacktop, which was a really, really good example early on of them overlapping riffs and of Hamilton kind of using his kind of jazz savvy but translating it into this kind of alternative rock format. Really famous track amongst Helmet fans is Sinatra, which has this like 3 minute descent into madness outro. Which is something that they pulled off really well live. You can see it in a few videos. I actually once went on tour with a Glaswegian band called Fighting Red Adair, who owe quite a bit of their sound to Helmet, I think, and who have since various members went on to do other projects. A And I remember very clearly during the tour that destroyed that band, and it was a very short tour and an absolute circus, which involved the police, which involved fights, it involved getting thrown out of houses, locked out, it involved vomit and insane amounts of booze, it involved a lot of stuff that shouldn't have happened.
That's not a great time.
It took years and years off my life. The tour had been sponsored by Jägermeister.
Oh, always a good sign.
And for three dates, they had been given, I think it was like 6 or 8 bottles of Jägermeister for mm-hmm. 3 days.
Yep.
Right. So I'm driving them on tour, and they, like, the guitarist drank an entire bottle of Jägermeister before he went on stage.
That is impressive.
Right. The results were not.
I can't imagine he could actually see anything by this point.
He'd had a lot of practice at drinking, to be fair, and notoriously so. But during the set, he got more and more drunk. And at first it was fine, and the set was devastatingly good. Fighting Red Adair are one of the best bands to come out of Glasgow. And at some point in the future, we'll do, much like the Dundee episode, we'll do a little analysis of that period, the Glasgow noise rock scene. And this concert, this guy got... You could visibly see him getting more and more drunk as the gig went on, as this huge amount of booze went into his system. So they had to encore, because we're in Brighton, of all places, a place called the Freebutt. And basically the guitarist got completely fucked, fell onto the ground on the stage while the band were still playing. And the crowd were like, keep playing. The bassist and the drummer, who were furious at the other guitarist, started playing Sinatra by Helmet. And they got through the first part of the song with the guitarist crouched on the ground playing the riff. But by the end of it, he just started projectile vomiting. But the thing is, the end of the song doesn't really end. Mm. It just grinds on and on. So on the album, it's maybe, 4.5 minutes?
Yeah.
Live, they made it 10. Mm. And they just kept the riff going and going, and the guitarist was whitey-ing all over the stage. And he'd whitey-ed so much that it was literally running off the edge of the stage like a little puke waterfall onto the ground. He couldn't stand up at this point. He crawled through his guitar strap, fell off the edge of the stage into his own vomit, and then crawled through the crowd as their driver. I'm like in the crowd face palming because I know I'm going to have to deal with this. And the rest of the band were still just playing this riff at the end of Sinatra, just noise. And the bass player is screaming in his face as he's throwing up, laughing, just watching this unfold. And honestly, it's the perfect visual for this song. The way this song ends is that gig. It didn't go so well after that. The police got involved.
But you can't do that every night either.
No, I mean, they literally broke up when they got back to the city. It was a disaster. But the sheer abandon in the band at this stage is incredible. There's so much energy in them. It's telling that one of my favourite songs of all time by Helmet is a track called Impressionable, mm-hmm. which I put on the compilation to you guys.
I've just seen that.
It's not actually on Strap It On. It's on the Japanese edition. Impressionable is a phenomenal song. I can't believe they didn't put it on the main version. John Stanier on that song is unreal, untouchable. It's much more traditionally hardcore. There's a drum roll, a snare roll in the middle of it that is the fastest fucking snare roll. And he goes straight into this final chorus that is even more furious than the two before. It's a must listen. If you're a Helmet fan and you don't have Impressionable, you really need to get your ears around that. And just also as a little note, I did the due diligence, and FBLA, it's a question that a lot of people ask, because there's FBLA on this album and then FBLA 2 on Meantime. It means Future Business Leaders of America. There you go. So Strap It On, though, as good as it is all the feral energy of Helmet, but without much of the melody. On the flip of that, you have Betty and later Aftertaste, where they'd passed Meantime, they'd passed that Goldilocks moment for me, the Goldilocks zone of Meantime, where they got the feral energy and they got the melody. And they went into this era of being slightly overblown. It's 14 tracks. The album could be maybe 3 or 4 tracks shorter. Definitely Street Crab is pretty by the numbers for them. Biscuits for Smut is just okay. It's interesting, but it's okay. Clean is like a 6 out of 10 by their standards. Beautiful Love is a needless little segue that just extends the album, and Sam Hell is an odd ending that again prolongs an album that could have been an absolutely dynamite album. The song Milk Toast in that album is a definite contender for the best Helmet song of all time. It's on the soundtrack to The Crow and was one of the first things by them that I really got into. Wilma's Rainbow that kicks this off is a really iconic Helmet riff. Tick is Helmet at their absolutely nihilistic best. Really ugly. The pacing, the weird structure of the riff. I Know is another example of them using space to allow John Stanier to really come through. A track for me that I put on the playlist that I gave you guys is a track called Speechless,
yeah,
which has these gigantic pauses between the riffs, like literally with nothing playing, like dead air, and it is so ballsy. I don't think this album's as mean or as ruthless as either of the earlier two albums, and I actually don't think the choruses are as strong as Aftertaste. I think it gets a little bit lost in no man's land, but I can understand why some people go to it, because it is a period of the band when they were at their most vital. They had this, and they had Meantime, and they had Strap It On, all in their live set, and they were untouchable in that genre. But I really don't think, if you're being objective, you can say blow for blow it's as good as Meantime. We jump into the Nexus?
Yeah,
let's
please
jump into the Nexus. Yeah, that would be ideal. Thanks.
It's the Unsung Podcast. Dave Grohl Nexus. Need to find a way to connect the show to that guy. For playing in Nirvana. It's the Unsung Podcast, Dave Grohl Nexus. Don't take too long. All right, you guys ready? Are you ready? Here we go!
So, who's going to go first in the Nexus?
I've got two, but Dave seems really excited about his.
No, I kind of need to sort it out a little bit.
Okay, I'll go first then.
Okay, Mark.
So, as I mentioned when you're talking about Betty, and as you mentioned when you're talking about Betty as well, Milk Toast is on the Crow soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. It is, and it's a beezer. That soundtrack's great.
Yeah, we'll probably cover that in a soundtrack episode at some point.
Yeah, mixtape.
So, yep.
Spoken about that, yeah.
Also on the soundtrack is Roland's Band.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Roland's Band had a guitar player called Chris Haskett.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris Haskett was also in a band.
You know, Henry Rollins introduced Dave Grohl on stage.
Yeah, no, but we've done that before, so.
Sorry.
Try to make it more interesting here, do you know what I mean?
I thought you were the guy that just went in like two jumps.
I've thought about this one though, right?
All right, okay.
Haskett also collaborated with many other people in a band or project called Pigface.
Yes, I remember that.
Mentioned before. By the way, which I found as part of my Christmas shopping, and one of our listeners is getting it as his Christmas present and he doesn't know yet.
Oh, hope he tells us. Pigface also had a collaborator and won Penn Jillette from Penn and Teller.
Is that true?
That's true.
I didn't know that.
Oh, guess we are now.
The Libertarian.
Yeah. With a red fingernail, red thumbnail, pinky nail, sorry. Penn Jillette was also in a band called Captain Howdy with fucking Debbie Harry.
No way, was he?
And Billy West from Futurama.
That's wild.
Fucking real thing that happened.
What a fact that is, man. That is superb.
Yeah, I thought it was worth getting to. And then recently in November.
That's maybe going to be up there. I mean, this could be for the Christmas special. We've got a favourite Nexus, and I may be scribbling to change this right now. But so I mean,
it's pretty good.
That's quite a good one, yeah. And Dave, Mr. Grohl, recently played Rapture by Blondie at a gig with St. Vincent and Beck, which was a memorial or sort of like a fundraiser thing for the Los Angeles County Museum of Arts.
That is pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Captain Howdy's brilliant. I've never heard of that. Yeah. That's superb. Wow.
Also had Captain Howdy also had Mark Kramer in it.
Who's
the
that?
Producer Kramer. He's done a lot of production stuff for a lot of really weird bands, including like John Zorn and all that.
Okay, cool.
He's actually played organ and stuff for Low on a couple of their records.
Okay, I think I'd know that. Is it me? All right, Div. You're looking at me. David has adjusted his position.
No, I'm just intrigued.
Sort of like, what's this lad going to say? All right, so Paige Hamilton in 2003 had a short, but I'm sure passionate...
Oh, he's gone for the same Nexus as me.
A short, but passionate affair with Winona Ryder.
Let's see where he goes. Winona Ryder, yeah.
Reiner.
Winona Ryder, all right.
Winona Ryder.
Where does he go after Ryder?
Which I actually remember, because I still picked up the occasional copy of Kerrang in 2003, and I remember the photos of them out as a power couple.
Mm-hmm.
So... Winona,
couple.
Winona Laura Ryder was named middle name Laura after the wife of Aldous Huxley.
Okay.
Who Laura Huxley?
Not a connection, though, is it? Carry on.
Excuse me, actually. No, excuse me, because Aldous and Laura Huxley were close family friends.
Okay, I'll give you
so
that.
So it is a connection. By the way, Winona Ryder's godfather, Timothy Leary.
Yeah, indeed.
Wow.
Crazy, yeah. Aldous Huxley, the family friend of Winona Ryder's family, David, wrote the book The Doors of Perception about his experiments with LSD, and The Doors, the band, took their name from the title of the book The Doors of Perception. Jim Morrison of The Doors, the crawling kingsnake himself, the backdoor man.
The backdoor man.
As me and Mark were listening to in the pub on the way here. Actually, at one point in his life, had an affair with the singer Nico of the Velvet Underground, or affiliated with the Velvet Underground, aka Christina Pafkin.
Yep.
And Nico, who, by the way, was encouraged in her solo career by Jim Morrison. Thanks, Jim. She, at one point in their relationship, apparently dyed her hair to look more like Jim Morrison's long-term partner, Pamela Courson, played by, what's her face? Sleepless in Seattle.
Meg Ryan.
Meg Ryan, I think, yeah. Which apparently really upset Jim Morrison. But Nico was also regarded as Andy Warhol's muse. That's a little bit patronizing these days, but she was. Andy Warhol, in 1968, nearly died after an assassination attempt by a radical feminist called Valerie Solanas, who had tried to shoot him. Valerie Solanas had been trying to get a play made based on something she'd written, and it was rejected by the woman who she pitched it to, and she then vowed to go and kill Andy Warhol in order to become notorious so that the play would then be made, because it had been written by Valerie Solanas, the killer of Andy Warhol. And she did, and actually it turned out the woman who she pitched it to, whose name I've forgotten, I'm sorry, phoned the police and said, this woman just pitched me a script. I rejected it. She said she's going to go and kill Andy Warhol. And the police were like, we can't go out there because somebody said she's going to kill Andy Warhol. Well, it turns out that hours later at the factory, Valerie Solanas had been waiting for Andy Warhol to arrive, and she shot him. And she didn't just shoot him, but she did. She missed him twice and also caught him as well. And Andy Warhol, apparently for the rest of his life, had to wear a corset because it held his internal organs in place due to the severe damage. Pierced both lungs, his spleen, his liver, everything. Whatever this bullet was, it was like pretty amazing shot.
What? How is that even medically possible to have a corset that holds your internal organs in? That can't be right. You'd be bleeding all the time.
From the operation, the internal musculature was affected in such a way that he would experience a lot of discomfort and pain based on his internal organs, like the scarring, the weakness, the damage that was done internally, shifting. And so the corset was designed to try and alleviate that pain.
So it wasn't actually to literally hold them in.
No, it wasn't like he was wide open.
Yeah,
you know, it wasn't like the game Operation. he wore this corset to sort of maintain the discipline of his internal organs and prevent him from excessive discomfort. Now, Valerie Solanas, she also wrote a thing called The Scum Manifesto, which is quite notorious because it advocated the elimination of men. And that was obviously a big part in her thinking about Andy Warhol. But anyway, Andy Warhol was scared of hospitals after that. And apparently his fear of hospitals and his failure to go and get diagnosed for a gallbladder stone, I believe, contributed to him ultimately dying as a result of the operation that he eventually got too late for that gallbladder stone. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. Valerie Solanas was played by the actress Lena Dunham in an episode recently of American Horror Story. Lena Dunham spoke in, I think it was 2016, at Howard Stern, the Shock Jocks, birthday event, despite Howard Stern having publicly said that Lena Dunham looked like Jonah Hill and was raping his eyes.
Oh, shit.
But she spoke at that event and it was all in you know, in good spirits. She gave as good as she got. And at Howard Stern's birthday event, sometime after Lena Dunham spoke, there was a musical performance by something of a supergroup that featured Robert Downey Jr., Bon Jovi, Steve Tyler, Ben Stiller, Sarah Silverman, David Letterman, and Dave Grohl.
Dave Grohl.
That sounds hideous. I'm not even going to lie.
What a fucking living.
So I should apologise for the length of that. I had a second Nexus. Can I just give you that very quickly?
As long as it's quick.
Paige Hamilton produced an album called Distort Yourself by the band Institute, which was a collaboration between Chris Traynor, also of Helmet, and Gavin Rossdale of Bush. And as everyone knows, Gavin Rossdale was also singer in Nirvana.
Singer in Nirvana, yes. Great work.
Dave, we're looking forward to this, Dave, go on.
Paige Hamilton, I don't know if you know, but in 2003 had a short-lived romance with Winona Ryder.
Winona Ryder? Where'd their name come from?
I don't care.
Actually, Winona Ryder isn't her name. She's got a Jewish name. She's Jewish.
Is this the first time that we've started with the same...
I think it is.
Out of all the Nexi.
Which is improbable.
Which is 156 Nexi. And it's the first one that we've gone with the same starting point.
I was talking to Mark earlier on, to be fair. And we didn't start all doing Nexi until about episode 34.
Oh, really? Yeah. All right, that's fine. So it's about 70 or something.
Who knows?
But the chance of it happening, given how ubiquitous Dave Grohl is, yeah, exactly. It's really slim. So
well, ubiquitous.
I'm drunk, leave me alone.
Winona Ryder starred in Bram Stoker's Dracula, 1992, directed by Francis Ford Coppola.
Is that one Gary Oldman in it?
Gary Oldman, yeah.
Yeah, great film, actually. Like, mad and
I kind of panned at the time, though, because it was much more of a love story than a horror.
Yeah, but it's pretty
it's
cool
aged
and
quite
cool
well. Yeah.
And the closing credit theme, Love Song for a Vampire, was written and performed by Dundee's finest,
so
Annie Lennox. Annie Lennox. Ox,
wow.
Yeah.
Annie Lennox.
Annie Lennox was appointed Glasgow Caledonian University's first female chancellor in 2017.
Good fact.
Taking over from Mohamed Yunus, a Nobel Peace laureate.
I'm very aware of Mohamed Yunus's work.
Now, previous...
that was not sarcasm.
Alumni of Glasgow Cali Uni also includes Kevin Bridges, the comedian, Anna Sloan, the curling bronze medalist of the 2014 Winter Olympics.
Obviously.
And also Gordon Brown, former British Prime Minister.
What? Really?
Yeah, he went to Glasgow.
He was
Cali.
The Prime Minister, yes.
Yeah. Gordon Brown, as well as being a fairly useless Prime Minister, is
To be fair, man.
Yeah, I know. Well, he was useless before we knew what useless could be.
Yeah, and I mean, it was a pretty difficult time, the whole, like, economic collapse. Didn't exactly do a lot to
I mean, yeah, he was one of the
Exchequer. Exactly. Anyway,
Gordon Brown is a big fan of Raith Rovers Football Club.
Who isn't?
That's true. Yeah.
I'm going pretty wide here, aren't I?
Yeah.
How is he going to get back on track?
You're literally an ocean away here.
Other supporters of Raith Rovers Football Club include Ian Rankin, the famous Edinburgh crime writer.
Wasp Factory.
He's actually got a street named after him in Fife in Cardenden.
Is it Rankin Street?
Old Rankin Street, yeah.
And also, Coldplay bassist Guy Berryman.
Fuck off.
Supports Raith Rovers.
Fuck off. No, he doesn't.
That's a true fact.
That fucking hipster cock. He just picked the most obscure fucking thing he could find to be cool.
Yeah, so Guy Berryman worked on some shite music.
Guy Berryman.
Berryman.
He did a collaboration with guys out of Mew.
Hang on, sorry, 2 seconds. Did you say he worked on some shit music project?
Yeah.
He's in Coldplay.
Well, obviously. And they made up the theme for the BBC Two series Amazon.
That's exactly what Coldplay are for.
Which was then included on an album called Songs for Survival, which was like a international environmental charity album. Also appearing on that album, featuring the Adi tribe, who are one of the most most populous indigenous peoples in the Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh.
Obviously.
They did a song with Skin from Skunk Anansie.
Of course they did.
Now, of course, Skin from Skunk Anansie was the singer in Skunk Anansie.
Can I just say about 15 minutes ago, David punched the air, and I didn't know why David was punching the air, and I now know why David was punching the air.
In 1995, Skunk Anansie supported Killing Joke in the Shepherd's Bush Empire.
Mm-hmm. Who Helmet have covered.
Mm-hmm. That would have been a much quicker way to get to this. And of course, Dave Grohl played drums on Killing Joke's album, Killing Joke.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So there you are. That's my nexus there.
It was really a beautiful diversion.
I mean, I got Gordon Brown and Wraith Rovers and Coldplay in there. And Annie Lennox.
Have you ever seen that episode of The Simpsons where they're going itchy and scratchy world and they're like, let's never speak of the diversion again. Or let's never speak of the shortcut again. That's what that nexus reminds me of.
Well, thanks, guys.
I like that. That was good. Thank you.
So the last bit of Fritz for again. 2018.
Are you guys ready? Are you
ready? There we go.
Final Fritz.
As good as ever.
What a man.
So, yeah, just to pick up.
Why meantime?
Okay, so in 95, Helmet had released Born Annoying, which was a collection of their early stuff. And I already said that really touches on some of that new wave post-punk stuff that they also have in their sound. The use of interesting layered guitars. There's a track in that called Taken, which I put on the compilation for you guys. I think it's a superb song. First of all, because it uses a stereo image. It's two guitars riffing in this kind of like contrapuntal way, and it bobs between the ears, and so if you're listening in headphones, it's just a brilliant thing. You can't help your eyes kind of flitting back and forward, and it's a brilliant, direct, brutal, simple bit of music. With his vocals and that really unvarnished, I mean, he knows his vocals sound like shit. That's the point of Helmet vocals. That kind of, it's just, it's part, it's a feature rather than a bug of Helmet. He knows that that's what he's going for. There's a few good covers in that, actually, as Dave just kind of could have mentioned. Primitive by Killing Joke is a really good cover in that. There's a song called Oven by Melvins, which can be an easy song to cover as well because the timings in it are pretty weird. Geisha to Go is almost a tribute to like their post-punk roots. It sounds almost like a bit like a really heavy version of Wire, and really shows like Paige Hamilton's kind of time in Band of Susans, I think. And also there's two versions of the track Born Annoying. There's an 89 version and 93 version. Born Annoying is a fantastic song. I actually prefer the 1989 version. It sounds a bit more like Strap It On to me. It's a bit more visceral. The 93 version is a slightly more claustrophobic, and it also has like a tapping solo in it, which obviously, given how good a musician Paige Hamilton is, I know he can do, but it isn't good. Don't do it, man. The 1989 version of Born Annoying is tremendous. Aftertaste, the 97 album, is really, really good. Aftertaste was recorded as a trio. As I said, they hadn't brought Chris Traynor in yet. Mengidi, whatever, had left by this point. It was my personal introduction to Helmet, so I guess it flies in the face of that whole theory about the first thing you hear is the thing you're attached to. But I am attached to it to some extent. I think it's like, there's things about this album that make me think of almost like power grunge. It's like stripped back to its elements. It doesn't have the crooning, but it's got the big, thick, layered guitar riffery. It's got a lot of drop D in it. There's a lot more choruses and hooks than any of the earlier stuff. The only thing about this album is, again, it's a little bit flabby. I think there's three or four tracks that probably could have come off it. It's also a little bit more po-faced. Helmet seemed a little bit more playful earlier on, even though they were subverting a lot of like hardcore cliches and tropes of like this macho genre. This album is a little bit sort of serious in its outlook. It does have some very good tunes. I think Renovation, the second track, is up there with one of Helmet's best, including the chorus. Birth Defect is really punchy and nasty, and it kind of harkens back to some of their earlier stuff. One I love personally is a song called High Visibility, which I put on the compilation I sent to you guys, where they strip it all down and it's really like Henry Bogdan, John Stanier for a lot of it, with Paige Hamilton singing over it. Find something mindless I can advocate. Make up the me I wanna be. A really simple riff motif that is very cleverly used, and also a really memorable tune, albeit a bit understated. Although for every one of them, there's tracks like Broadcast Emotion, Harmless, Insatiable, and even the opening track, Pure, I think are okay. Mm-hmm. They're good, but it could have been a leaner album, I think. Again, it's an album that could have been stripped down to 10 or 11 songs, like Meantime, and all the songs would have benefited as a result. But it is overall, for me, very underrated. It's seen as being a more commercial turn for the band. As I say, it's a bit less obstinate. In the Goldilocks metaphor, it leaves a lot of the kind of hotter, nastier, early stuff behind and goes more for that tuneful, grungy thing, and maybe over-eggs that pudding a little bit. But in their canon, it's a really, really good record. And I think if you like Helmet and you don't own the first four albums, what the fuck are you doing? They broke up actually after that album. The tour from that, like I said, was the one that really killed them. Mengedi had already left in 93, but
had him playing in Biohazard.
Yeah, and he also formed the band Handsome. Who we've mentioned a few times on this podcast, and Handsome are really good. They only had one album, self-titled. Handsome's album sounds like a very polished version of this kind of era. Helmet. A polished Helmet.
A polished Purple Throbber.
Exactly. But as I said, the band really kind of fell apart. Now, what happened after that was that it was about 6 years of a hiatus. Stanier was out the picture, Bogdan was out the picture. You just really had Chris Traynor, who'd come in for the Aftertaste tour, and Paige Hamilton. Now they, somewhat foolishly in my opinion, got back together again, did Size Matters in 2004, which was much anticipated because people really thought maybe this is going to be amazing. That album performed really badly and ended up getting them dropped by Interscope. Hamilton was kind of in full creative control mode. The album's totally competent, but it's very uninspiring. It has some moments, a song called Crashing Foreign Cars, which is really not bad. It's pretty full on. But there's a hell of a lot of filler in that record. They followed that in 2006, trying to get that bottled lightning effect of their early career. They actually re-recruited Wharton Tears, who'd done their first album, and the album does have a much rawer feel to the production. you can hear them deliberately trying to rediscover the naivety, and it sounds very forced. It's not terrible, but at times it's terrible. It's a hard thing to articulate. At times, if you're in the album and you get snapped out of it, you're like, holy shit, this sounds like a bad Helmet covers band. But then at other moments in the album, like the track Brand New, it's kind of good. Until you realise that this is the sound of a band ripping off Helmet. So this is the sound of the zombie Helmet ripping off Helmet. And that's kind of distasteful. It's actually the song Brand New, as good as it is. One of the reasons it's good is because it's almost identical to Turned Out from Meantime, at least for the first minute and a half. Also, like, the fucking album cover for this album is so bad. It looks a little bit like an aircraft pilot who's got one of, you know, those towels that you pull in a toilet where you pull it down and then it only goes so far, and then you pull it down and it only goes so far to dry your hands. Like, it looks like that's over his face. I mean, it is moronically bad. It's a sketch. I don't know what the fuck they were doing. 2010, they did Seeing Eye Dog. The cover looks like it's a demo by some high school band. It's terrible, basically. Why is the band still going at this point? You can't find this album on Spotify. I don't know if that's a coincidence or not. And then 2016, they did an album called Dead to the World, which is just not completely dreadful, but completely irrelevant. Like, nothing new brought to the table. There's a track on it actually called Bad News, which has the doubled vocal effect and the kind of diminished poppy jazz chords of Foo Fighters. It really sounds like Foo Fighters.
Is that possibly because it's got Bill Stevenson as a co-writer who was in Black Flag and is in the Descendants as a drummer?
I don't know.
That could have a lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Possibly.
He is one of the key songwriters in the Descendants. So.
The only thing is, Hamilton is fiercely protective of his status as the pilot of Helmet, the project. As much as Bill Stevens is a big character, I find it pretty hard to imagine that Hamilton would let many people encroach on his songwriting.
Well, he's a co-writer on that in Red Scare.
It's in the credits.
Well, maybe then. Also, that album has by far their worst song, a track called Green Shirt.
What's a Costello, Elvis Costello cover?
It is a horrendous decision to cover that song. But you shine all the buttons on your green shirt. You can please yourself, but somebody's gonna get it. It is so bad. It is fucking unforgivable. I don't know what they were thinking. And I think that kind of stands there as like an example of what the fuck happens. How many years later is that? 18 years after they originally broke up. You've got this one guy now who's just assumed control of this brand and is just, without any dissenting voices now, steering it deeper and deeper and deeper into the junkyard. What are you doing? Move on. John Stanier moved on. He took a year out from drumming. Like, he apparently, after 98, basically went on hiatus himself and rediscovered his mojo and got into Battles and Tomahawk and all these great projects that had something new to bring to the table. Henry Bogdan apparently went and started playing steel guitar, lap steel, for a bunch of other projects, country projects. Why has Paige Hamilton been so resistant to the idea that Helmet, as a relevant entity, may be done, and maybe it's okay to do something new without diminishing the previous quality? Everybody that tunes into their newer material, especially as a result of, say, this podcast, is like, what is this shit? And you're having to immediately disentangle it from their good early stuff. And you're like, I shouldn't have to do that. Admit that it's a different cast, it's a completely different outlook on music. Move on, do something else. There's no shame in that. I think they're a perfect example of when that should have happened. How familiar were you guys with Helmet?
One of my best friends who I've played in a couple of bands with, he's a huge Helmet fan and a huge Willhaven fan. After listening to this, after listening to Willhaven, I can totally understand where his guitar playing comes from.
Both, you know, it's funny you mention them because I hadn't considered that, but both have a very distinct and very innovative approach to heavy music that is like...
I find Willhaven have a lot more groove though.
Yeah, they're definitely a much more groovier band.
Because I think part of what Helmet is this very rigid, sort of constrained thing that they have going on.
Oh, so their record comes, I mean, the record we did comes 10 years after this one.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
And this, they said themselves, this massively influenced it. So I think it's, you know, you're trying to appraise it on its merits rather than...
For me, Helmet were a band that I missed, I think, because of my age. I kind of got into metal...
Rub it in.
...when they were over. But I got into bands that they had influenced, you know. So when I was 14, it was, you know, 1999, 2000. So I was hearing a lot of the stuff that was
Korn and Deftones.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And Willhaven, exactly.
Yeah.
Previously, and I think I'd downloaded, you know, I'd probably downloaded a couple of the big ones off LimeWire or whatever to, you know, educate myself. But it's interesting that it never stuck with me. When I was 14, I immediately went to Pantera, and I didn't immediately go to Helmet, and I wonder why that is.
There are two bands that I think you'll find in a lot of people's libraries, though. Like, if you like Pantera, there's a very good chance you'll like Helmet.
Yeah.
Both on the Crow soundtrack.
I mean, you listen to Turned Out...
That's true, actually. The Badge is the Pantera track in that, isn't it?
You listen to Turned Out, and there's definitely parts of Vulgar Display of Power on that.
Turned Out's a really, really particularly good song.
Yeah. But for me, it just doesn't quite have the groove of it. And also, like, the production isn't nearly as crushing as Pantera either.
It's less metallic, I think, and that's why...
Yeah, it's definitely less of a fully metal album than Pantera.
I think that Helmet are noise rock, the definition of noise rock at a lot of points, but also alternative rock, more so than metal.
They seem to have somehow completely missed the grunge label. Somehow.
This record is really fucking 90s.
Yeah, they are an American band that came out in 1992 with riffs.
First of all, they were on the opposite coast, though. I know we've
yeah,
talked...
Yeah, I suppose, geographically speaking.
He would have been in Portland, Oregon, but he moved to New York City and ended up much closer to bands like Biohazard than he did Soundgarden. But there are points in Helmet's canon where they do riffs like Soundgarden, they cover Melvins, and they were big into Melvins. The two bands were on the same label. I'm sure they played together a number of times.
Bad Motorfinger came out, like, a couple of months before this. Like, I read a lot about the jazzy chords and things that I was expecting on this record. Actually just kind of sounded a bit like Soundgarden, but without the lead guitar. Like, you listen to You Borrowed, and then you go and listen to Outshined or Room 1,000 Years Wide, and it's kind of the same riff and the same sort of chord progressions happening there. It was a lot more grungy than I was expecting.
Yeah, I think Helmet, though, I mean, they got grungier. Betty is a little bit grungier, and Aftertaste is like a polished version of grunge. As grunge kind of went into mainstream.
And his vocals developed a more melodic sort of slant.
But I do think that one of the things about Helmet is that they were all about bursting the bubble, the pompousness of things like grunge. And they would probably balk at a lot of those comparisons because... I fucking love Soundgarden as a band, especially their later career, but they were incredibly pompous and shirtless, and as we know, Helmet liked a good shirt. But
loved a good shirt.
A lot of what Helmet did, without overcooking it, they subverted a lot of tropes. They subverted the tropes in the East Coast with Biohazard and the macho vest-wearing bullshit, Agnostic Front, all these bands. They could play with them. But they also had...
Nothing like Agnostic Front, though. Nothing like that.
That's actually not strictly true, man. See, if you go through Agnostic Front's earlier stuff, when they slow down, going into beatdowns, a lot of it is very like Helmet. And a lot of Helmet's earlier stuff, the faster stuff, overlaps that. Biohazard obviously is a lot more obvious, the comparison. Mm-hmm. without being too apparent, they really tried to subvert those tropes. But equally, whilst being grungy and stodgy and down-tuned, they tried not to lean into this over-earnest stadium rock of the West Coast and the grunge explosion. So they were kind of like in no man's land a little bit, but yet by being in no man's land, by not fitting into either of those scenes perfectly, they forged this new thing.
I would agree that they're in a no man's land, but I am aware that you bought me some lovely Christmas presents here today. You've also given me some ginger beer.
Uh-oh.
Marks.
And you've never been more excited about an album in your life. But also, I have to get revenge for how much you fucking slagged Carly Rae Jepsen yesterday, right? They are in a no man's land, but like for me, they're in a no man's land in that they don't have the intensity or dissonance of like alt rock stuff like Jesus Lizard. They don't have the groove or the heft of Pantera. They don't have like the progressive ideas of Ministry. These are like all bands that are coming out like 1991, 1992. They don't have the melody or the depth of Soundgarden and like that sort of stuff. And they don't have the anger of hardcore stuff like Biohazard, Roland's Band. To me, I wanted to like this record. I thought I was going to like this record, but it just completely left me flat. I struggled to give a shit about it. I was just like, I listened through their stuff, and to be honest, I think their earlier stuff was way more interesting because they were trying to do more stuff.
Yeah.
I was like, there's things going on there, but what they did was like, they seemed to have stripped things back to a very focused and very clear and very rigid and constrained sound on this album. Yeah, I just could not get it. I was like, I was very bored, and I'm very aware of how influential they were. And I think if I heard this in 1992, I'd have been like, this is fucking amazing. But having seen bands build on this for 25 years and also bands do shit versions of this, it's kind
including
of been
my own band, by
it's kind of been tainted for me. I was only hearing the cliches in it, even though I'm very aware that those cliches weren't around when it came out.
I think that's interesting. I think it says a lot about your tastes, because all the things you just said, so the machismo and aggression of Biohazard, the pompousness, the stadium rock of Soundgarden, the kind of arrogant groove rock swagger of Pantera, the atonality and sort of febrile nature of Jesus Lizard, Helmet didn't have those. And for a lot of people, those were the things about those bands they hated. Yeah. They, like, a lot of people loved Jesus Lizard when they kicked into a Thumbscrews. A lot of people loved Pantera when they weren't total douchebags, which was kind of unavoidable because they were. A lot of people loved Biohazard for the riffs, but as soon as he opened his mouth, they were like, fuck off. And a lot of people like Soundgarden, but they just couldn't get past the fucking pompousness of the whole thing. And Helmet were the band that eschewed a lot of those alienating characteristics. So I totally respect what you said. Yeah. In the sense that,
and I can totally,
you love those eccentricities, you love people leaning in, pushing these boundaries of these different
parts.
Yeah,
but parts. I'm aware I'm looking at all of these records as an outsider, because these records all came out when I was 6 years old, so I'm just looking at
you
them.
Weren't listening to them,
so
what the fuck.
So I'm sell going out. Back and I'm just listening to these things musically.
Yeah,
I'm not necessarily thinking about where they stand culturally or
totally, but sensibilities wise it is interesting that the eccentricities or the exaggerated aspects of those bands are a lot of what drew you to them, whereas
it's the songwriting and the riffs and the production.
Yeah, but
like,
I mean,
I listen to Bad Motorfinger, I really like the riffs. I don't particularly like the crooning. I've never watched Soundgarden live, and I couldn't give a shit what they're like live, and you know, like Chris Cornell's ego or charisma or whatever. And with Pantera, it's like that crunching riff and the groove. These are all things that were just missing for me for Helmet, and I really gave it a go. There's something about their constrained rhythms that just I could not pick up on. And I wish I liked it, but to me it just it was like angry in an old man sort of way,
there's not a lot of joy, I'll totally agree with that. It's not so much joy, it's more of that kind of Chris Morris awareness of what's going on and avoiding falling into those, and little nods to the fact that this is something you expect us to do, we're deliberately not going to do it. This is something that by doing it, we are now deliberately distancing ourselves from this band. So for example, Biohazard, on a riff basis, that band kicks ass. as a band, they're ridiculous. It's impossible to take a Biohazard record or video seriously. Likewise, with early Soundgarden, I mean, Super Unknown's a different kettle of fish, let's put that to one side, but anything before that, I cannot with a straight face listen to Bad Motorfinger given the sheer pretentiousness of that music. There are great riffs, but I have to try and get round the other circumstances. Pantera, the cheeseball, corny metal stuff. Now, what I mean is,
I think it's interesting you say about Pantera, man, because Ogre Display of Power came out the year before this record, right? And that was fucking, at the time, that would have been straight up metal, right? That would not have been cheesy. It is totally cheesy now.
It's OTT,
it's not even
though.
That cheesy. Cowboys from
Hell
has
it's got super cheesy.
No,
I mean, they were a fucking hair metal band to begin with,
I mean,
though, right?
Vulgar Display of Power is OTT macho as fuck.
Of course it is, man. It's and got Helmet, a fucking guy punching another guy in the face, yeah, with a cover.
No, that's exactly it. And Helmet, but Helmet, even their, like, even their imagery, the whole thing about Helmet, the name of the fucking band, the everything about them was a very, very subtle play on that. An awareness of we're working in an environment here where this machismo is a huge currency. But Helmet really did a lot to subvert that. And that subversiveness is what makes them different. Now, I'm not disputing what Dave says. I really respect that as an appraisal of this album. But all I'm saying is it's interesting how that divides people, because some people were really alienated by that machismo of Pantera and Biohazard.
Absolutely, yeah. And
other people,
with good reason.
And
know.
Those people, like me, like a number of the bands that I grew up playing alongside, the people in my own band, we went to bands like Helmet. We still loved the riff, but we could not abide those metallic tropes. Dave's a guy that can listen to that and put it to one side. Well, I'm not a guy that can listen to that and put it to one side. And so for me, Helmet was the answer. Helmet was the band that I went to when I wanted that riffery and I wanted that slight sense of self-awareness without being overly nudge, nudge, wink, wink. They were that compromise.
Maybe as a boy from the Highlands who didn't get to see like a heavy band until he was 18 because nobody fucking played in Inverness.
Terrorvision.
I'm very removed from the type of people that go to those gigs. And also, I didn't go to a gig until 2002. So when I listen to Pantera or I listen to Soundgarden, I'm removed from those things that you're not removed from.
Mm-hmm.
And I can totally see and respect why Helmet were this band that stood out.
You know, it was okay to like Nirvana and to like Helmet. It was not particularly okay to like Nirvana and to like Pantera, because Pantera were on the cusp of that cock rock part of the industry that was, as we know, slightly racist, misogynistic, chauvinistic, and Helmet were not. And that was the thing. So growing up being a Nirvana kid, I can love Helmet unreservedly because none of those things went along with that band. Whereas those other bands, a lot of those things went along with them, and Helmet were on the right side of that line.
Yeah.
I think because I've come to Helmet later because of this podcast and because of the people I know.
Can I just say, we have so many sound bites of innuendo.
Yeah, I know. I quite like Helmet.
Sorry, you were saying because you came to Helmet later.
I came to Helmet because Helmet came later to me.
At you. On you.
On me. In the beard. because I discovered Helmet later.
We're not going to escape just, it, man. Yeah, just take it.
Just
take
gone.
It full
it's
on.
It's fucking gone, man.
Take the helmet.
Just I have multiple helmets.
Yeah, take it on the chin.
If you can find it. Because I happened upon this record later.
Meantime.
Yeah. I can't separate the cheesy new metal riffs that I grew up listening to from this record, because they come from this record and they also come from Pantera as well. Like, we talked about the new metal bands that were like responsible for it, but Pantera, pretty much all new metal bands, in fact, pretty much all metal bands since Pantera fucking still play Pantera riffs. And new metal bands,
yeah,
like,
but Sepultura as well, man. Pantera were not the discovery of
they were
those
not, but they had
riffs.
They were the biggest band, right, at the time, that had the most amount of groove, which is what automatically played into a new metal. Now Helmet obviously had some groove, but they were not as groovy as Pantera were,
and they didn't try
near.
To be.
Yeah, however,
you have to remember, man, that Helmet also informed math rock. Helmet, the whole concept of like irregular bars of like 5-4, 4-4, 5-4.
Yeah,
Helmet were pioneers of that. So the groove aspect of it wasn't as big a priority.
That's true. But right, so classic Wikipedia, right? But it's got a list of all the bands that Helmet have influenced.
This is a long episode,
right? And it's yeah, I know, and it's great because you know I can totally recognize how they've influenced bands like Mastodon, like Botch.
Very much so, yeah. Mastodon.
Like Norma Jean,
Norma Jean's guitarist Norma Jean's guitarist said that Helmet is the band that made him start playing guitar, and that he's only ever aspired to be as good as that band.
And indeed Tool as well. But then you also look Lost Prophets, Linkin Park, Godsmack, Stained, 3 Days Grace. When I listened to it, I was like, I can hear a lot of the shit that they have.
That's not their fault.
No, I know, but like, going back to it, having
Rage Against the Machine made Limp Bizkit. Rage Against the Machine made all like Head PE. Faith No More. Let's be honest, Faith No More, more than any of these bands.
I know,
Faith No More.
But I listened to Faith No More when I was a teenager, so it's been untarnished. Going back and listening to this for the first proper time, I get all the...
You know, it's the same experience you had, like, you guys had listening to the AFI or Against Me as well. It's like,
coming to
this later, it's a thing, you know, it's like...
Yeah, it's difficult to look at it out with context of what it's influenced.
You hear the decades of pish that's come after it, I get that. And it's the same with Descendants as well, man, to be fair. But I do think, one of the things that, the reason I made that playlist up for you guys, and I think we will put the playlist up on the thread so the audience can hear what we had. The only problem is that Spotify doesn't have some of the stuff, so we'll try and work out a way to do that. But one of the reasons I gave you that playlist is because, Dave, I had like a little instinct that maybe you would kind of feel this, and I totally understand it. But I think for that reason, the early stuff, Strap It On, the stuff on Born Annoying,
the early stuff is what I got into because it's noisier and
furious. It's
more
so visceral.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just more energetic, less
boring. Can I ask how many people in 2018 said the word visceral at exactly the same time?
Oh, look at that.
We are on the same fucking page. Right, so just, you know, very quickly, we have to finish this episode because it's an epic and we've still got to get more drunk. The first track, in the meantime, is an iconic riff by Helmet. The way the track opens, the actual riff itself, the melodic release in the chorus, it's just a fucking absolute riff fest, that song, and the drum work at the end.
Boring
as well.
Riffs, but riffs.
Right. Track 2, Ironhead, is another like really obvious subversion of New York hardcore, I think, at the time. It sounds really simple, but the overruns in the bar really fuck with you, and he knows what he's doing. The vocals are really ugly. It's got that trademark kind of anti-solo that Helmet did so well. Track 3, Give It, is the first point in Helmet's career as well where they said, we are not just a hardcore band. It's the first point where they really embraced melody, albeit awkward and difficult and still quite heavy and quite sludgy. The riff timings and the really helps unsettle you, and there's like a really lethargic kind of druggy chorus that's in it. I love the line as well that's in that song, killing hurts, but it has to be done. I just think like little sound bites like that were vintage Helmet. Track 4, our namesake, Unsung,
the most listened to track on Spotify by quite some margin
in the whole of Spotify
before Helmet.
That song is a masterclass in like musical economy. I think it's a rock song that is full of riffs, it's full of ideas, but they've obviously, it probably was 2-3 minutes longer when they first wrote it. They've stripped it back, it's lean, there's a lot of space in it for John Stanier to come through. It's a track that I think this is something we've not necessarily mentioned in past episodes. It's a track that has hooks on every instrument, right? So see, in that song, there's vocal hooks, there's guitar, there's bass, and there's drum hooks all the way through that song. So every instrument is pulling its weight, and that's why I think it stands out so much in my head. And it's such a powerful CV for that band.
The song Phaser by Quicksand reminds me of that a lot.
Well, Quicksand were like contemporaries of Helmet, and it was a guy from Quicksand that went on to do Handsome with Mengid. We still haven't established that. turned out, Dave mentioned, I love that song. It's got this 5-4 time in. It's thuggly. It's got this, like, it deliberately plays up the, as Dave said, the kind of Pantera-y New York hardcore kind of tropes. But the odd timing really is something those guys just didn't do. They straighten out the time signature at the chorus and in the second verse. But that second verse goes into palm mutes, which is just fucking nasty with an R. And that song just loses its shit at the end as well, which I think is brilliant. It goes back to their noise rock. He Feels Bad is a song that is loads of room for John Steiner to come through. It's a really innovative bit of writing for the time, which I think, again, in retrospect, is maybe easy to overlook. Hamilton is just reining himself in on all those bars, and I think it's really understated how much songs like that, which are album tracks by Helmet, are influential on, new metal, but also the better stuff that followed after it. And talking of better, the track Better, I think that rolling kind of muted riff that shifts over the drum signature, the really simple chorus, which is just designed for moshing. Brilliant and succinct and economical and just really, really well used. You Borrowed is probably like a post-grunge thing. It's got bits of Soundgarden and Melvins in the riffs, but has like an overall more of a slacker feel. FBLA2, the follow-up to the one in the Strap It On. Really great drum beat, like a really, really interesting drum beat. John Steiner starting to really come through as like a celebrity within the alternative rock scene. Lost senses. He's allowed loads of room in that, and it descends into that noise rock thing that Helmet do. And it descends into some of the best Steiner drumming of the first 10 years of that guy's career. Like the end of that song, some of the drum parts he plays are just a sign of things to come. They show you what the guy was capable of. And then finally, that song Role Model is one of the few points where Henry Bogdan really gets to shine. It's probably the most straight ahead song in that album, but it then goes into the anti-chorus thing. I love that record. I think it ticks all the boxes. We've got to wrap up, obviously, but just a couple other points to mention. Custard Pie, Helmet's collaboration with David Jow, the cover of Led Zeppelin, is a fucking brilliant cover, like absolutely excellent. Helmet were a band that ticked off a lot of boxes with good covers. They did a cover of the song Gigantor, which is the opening credit song of a cartoon. It's on a Saturday morning compilation where they got full bands to cover Saturday morning tunes like Spider-Man and stuff like that. They've got a famous cover of Lord of This World by Black Sabbath, and they've also got that legendary collaboration with House of Pain, Just Another Victim. Which is on the soundtrack to Judgment Night, which is another soundtrack.
And will be getting played on Saturday night.
It will be getting played on Saturday night.
So we don't have to ask if you want it in the Discord.
Before we guys do that, I know that you've spoken, I know Dave, you've spoken about how you don't like record, and I know you've spoken about how much you love it.
Mm-hmm.
And much
Mark
like,
hasn't really had a chance to
Much like Khalid Jepsen, I'm kind of in the middle, but obviously, but more on the side of like, I actually kind of like this record. We're talking about having to absorb 25 years of the of the influence and the shit that it's spawned. Is something that was
good and bad, yeah,
quite difficult to remove when I was listening to it from my mind. But there's also stuff about it that I really liked, you know, like the guitar playing is phenomenal. The groove.
Can I just pick up on something you said there, man? One of the best things about the guitar playing on this is the fact that Paige Hamilton is a world class jazz guitarist.
He underplays all the time.
Exactly. He distills that down to the most concentrated, refined points. And it is just like, it is musical cordial. Much like Duane Dennison, who's similar. It is so interesting that these guys had that training behind them and chose to apply it in this way.
I think that's one of the things we haven't really spoken about at all in this podcast. When it comes to guitar players, usually the best guitar players are the ones that go most unrecognised as well, are the ones that know about economy. Ultimately, that's what it's about, you know. The best bands that we all like, most of the records we've picked, they don't have like flashy playing for the most part, right? I can't really think of any, with the exception of some of the longer records, like, you know, Godspeed You Black Emperor, you know, the Dirty Three, the ones which actually play with more classical kind of components. Most of the stuff we're talking about is about economy, you know, it's about getting the message across.
Have we had maybe At the Gates is like the most,
it's the same though, like it's all like, although it's quite jumpy, it's about economy. So none of the songs go for 4 minutes, and a lot of metal bands who play that kind of music are easily going to fucking bypass that, you know. And that's why the record's so good, because our record's less than
maybe the three of us just have ADHD.
Possibly, but on the other hand, I mean, the Meshuggah record's quite long.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to try and suggest a Finnish black metal band that has 4 22-minute songs on its album in the next few months. Amazing. So.
For the most part, though,
spoiler
we've remained quite about economy, because it is all about the good tunes at the end of the day for us, right? That's kind of the main thing. You know, Paige Hamilton's a good example of that. You know, he does things, not just things that people have ripped off to the nth degree, but he does things in a really intricate, without being intricate sounding way. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
No, I know.
It sounds
I know,
like,
I know
it sounds
exactly
like a really weird thing
to
say.
It's carefully considered. Yeah, uh-huh. I just wish he'd fucking stopped.
That's the sadness of it though, right? It's like he's obviously still ploughing the same furrow, which is the field's dead, man. I mean,
okay,
stop it.
So folks, we're going to put up the compilation that I gave to these guys, because I'm a helmet enthusiast. There we go.
Hey-o.
I am an unabashed helmet enthusiast. I'm red in the face even just talking about it, but I put together like a collection of what I think are some really interesting choice cuts of Helmet across their career. Please have a listen to it, because there's stuff mixed in there that is really superb. I think that collection is probably better than this album, but I think this album is the definitive and albeit their most successful, but still under-recognized album in terms of the influence and the prescience that it showed for what guitar music could become in the decades that followed, and often did. I think it's absolutely still an unsung classic.
I
required reading.
I think it sounds like an angry dad in a garage deciding to start a band. Do you know, I kept having, you know how you get visions, you have like synesthesia. My vision for this was an annoyed dad trying to fix a lawnmower, and then when it wouldn't work, he was like, "Ah, fuck it, I've got to start a band." Also, it sold 2 million records, so it's not that unsung.
But it sold 2 million records at a time when any alternative rock band sold 2 million records.
And then looking back at the Kerrang,
it's so bold of Khalid Jepsen.
Well, yeah, that's true. And then looking back at Kerrang albums of the year, 1992, it came sixth. Number five was Ministry, Psalm 69, and number seven was Pantera, Vulgar Display of Power. I think in that particular
album
sandwich, I much prefer the bread than the filling.
So funny, but I still say it's a whopper.
I think I'm indifferent, man.
That was a joke.
I know, but I'm tired of the jokes now. There's so many.
I'm tired of the podcast.
I just want to go to bed, man. Let me sleep, fuck's sake.
Right, kill it.
Okay.
Thanks.
Go and vote on Facebook and also give us some reviews, please.
And we'll see you next week talking about...
Oh, it's going to be
our year.
So good.
It's
talking
our
about
festive
our year
special part one.
Thank you so much for 52 weeks.
Cheers, guys.